Hello and welcome back to the GM Cancer Podcast, a podcast brought to you by the Greater Manchester Cancer Alliance. I'm Steve Bland, and this is the podcast that takes you inside cancer services here in our wonderful region of Greater Manchester. Now, this is the first of a new series of monthly episodes that we're doing, looking at cancer in the news, exploring and looking into a little bit in a bit more depth how cancer is making the news each month. And for this one, I'm joined by the Associate Medical Director of the GM Cancer Alliance, Matt Everson. Hello, Matt.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Yeah, really well, thank you.
Excellent. So it's been a really interesting month for cancer, as I guess every single month is. We've had the King revealing his diagnosis. We had Chris Hoy, the Olympic cyclist, revealing under some duress that he'd been diagnosed with cancer. We've had the death of the wonderful chef, Dave Myers, the hairy biker. And it's interesting, isn't it, Matt? Because we see these big spikes every time someone in the public eye reveals that they've been diagnosed. For example, after the King was diagnosed, there was a 51% increase in searches for, in searches on a site, on an NHS site, you know, broadly talking about the signs and symptoms of cancer. It's always down to the individual, isn't it, how much they share of a story. But that said, it's really kind of helpful in a way to the broader kind of awareness picture, you know, when we get these big celebrities sharing they've been diagnosed.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, it's brave, and it has to help save lives. I guess the way I see it is, it kind of just maybe subconsciously underpins that message. Cancer doesn't discriminate in any way. One in two of us will suffer cancer or be affected by cancer in our lifetimes. And it does not discriminate. No matter who you are, you can be the King of England, King of Great Britain, and be affected by cancer. And I think that may be the message. It's, this can happen to anybody. And so anybody reading that piece of news can think, right, that could be me. I want a better understanding. How do I arm myself and empower myself with the knowledge that means I can look out for those symptoms? Which symptoms do need to go and be checked out? It is the early diagnosis of cancer is all about that, the vigilance for symptoms, the early recognition and the early action based on those symptoms. And it's empowering everyone with the knowledge that supports that. And so every time there is something in the news, it's doing good. It's talking about cancer helps to save lives. And that, it must be an incredibly brave decision to such a difficult and stressful time to share that publicly for the greater good.
It's difficult for someone like the King, isn't it, to keep anything quiet?
Yeah.
I know, you know, a lot of people, when, you know, when Chris Hoy revealed, he sort of intimated, didn't he, that maybe there was a story going to come out in a newspaper or something, and I think everyone leapt on the journalists. You know, me as a journalist, former journalist, I sort of, you know, started defending journalists a little bit, because I don't, you know, if I was a journalist and someone at the hospital told me the King's been in, he's been treated, I'd be thinking that's a massive story.
However it's come about, or whatever's driven that decision making, the benefit is that breaking down the taboos of any cancer diagnosis, that it can happen to anybody. We did some public insight work. It was focused around lung cancer, but some public insight work as to what makes it really difficult to for someone to go and seek help if they have a symptom that might be caused by lung cancer. And there's some really interesting kind of findings from it, and some really quite tragic findings, that some people could see symptoms as not being worthy of being looked at. So they could, that you know, that it's just a cough. I can get coughs all the time. Or that the NHS and the health service is overwhelmed. So why would I go and see them with this, what could be interpreted as a relatively minor sign? Or it's not going to be me. You know, I don't, that couldn't be me. Or I don't want, if it is, I don't want to know. I want to bury my head in the sand. And all of those things kind of conspire together to make it just a really challenging step to take. You may have recognized that this symptom might, you know, could be linked to cancer, but to take that step of getting help, there's all these barriers in the way. And so by putting it into the public eye and knowing that this can happen to anybody, or symptoms that could have a taboo around them can happen to anybody, and that they need investigating, that validation and that endorsement of you should and need to get this checked. And it, you know, the earlier something is caught, the better, the more chance we can treat this successfully. The more that conversation is happening in the public eye, the more it benefits that person sat there thinking, should I get this checked out? Should I not? Am I going to take action? Am I not?
And it is massive, the impact, isn't it? We saw after, my good friend Dame Deborah James, after she died, 120% increase in people looking at the bowel cancer symptom section of the NHS website.
Yeah.
You know, there were huge jumps in number of referrals for bowel cancer. And I was, you know, it's nothing new, is it? You're going back years and years and years. Jade Goody, when she died, you know, we saw the same kind of spike in people attending their smear tests.
Yeah.
But I guess the challenge is, and, you know, one of the issues is that, you know, quite often those spikes aren't maintained. The levels aren't maintained, are they? They come back down again, you know, when the interest in that person might, you know, perhaps goes away.
Yeah.
So how do you, as someone that works in this area, how does the Alliance, how do hospitals and trusts, maintain those levels of interest or those levels of people attending their smear tests or whatever it might be?
Yeah. Well, that's our responsibility. And we have to see that and own it as our responsibility. So we have to think about public awareness campaigns that will support and encourage and engage with local communities to seek help when there's a symptom that could be linked to cancer, to attend for where there are screening programs for cancers. We have to understand what the barriers could be and put things in place to try and overcome them. I'll probably frequently come to lung examples because it's the thing I know inside out. But those barriers I was talking about, one of the ways we've thought of as an alliance of overcoming those, a chest x-ray is one of the first tests you need if you've got symptoms that could be caused by lung cancer. But there are real concerns by people about attending for a chest x-ray and what might happen if they go with those symptoms, whether they'll be dismissed, whether they'll be told it's nothing, or maybe they don't see themselves at risk. So we've put a pilot in place around a self-referral chest x-ray. We've talked about it before, where actually someone can just turn up for an x-ray without the request of a healthcare professional. And that seems, for a certain group of people, that draws people in to say, I will get it checked because there's a way that makes me feel comfortable in doing that. And so that just the ethos of understanding what the barriers are and trying to put something in place that addresses those barriers and addresses it for everyone. We think of every single person and every single community and how do we overcome the barriers that might be in front of them to encourage early presentation, early diagnosis. It's that action. It's linking the symptom to possible cancer and then making action easier than inaction. Because sometimes, for some, I think inaction is the easier option. How do we make action the easy option?
What do you think about the way the media does deal with these kind of things? Because it strikes me that, you know, it's no surprise. There's an awful lot of sensationalism when it comes to things like cancer, even down to reporting of, you know, a bit of research that might have made a breakthrough. All of a sudden, the cancer cure is here and, you know, we're all going to be saved. And then, you know, perhaps when somebody dies, I can remember when Sarah Harding, the Girls Aloud singer, died, there was a lot of very tabloidy reporting of that. I think it's difficult, isn't it? Because there's an issue, you know, we know an issue around language and cancer, particularly for people affected by cancer, really don't like a lot of, for example, the battle language and things. So how do you think, in general, the media deals with cancer-related stories?
I guess within every walk of life, there are some really positive things and there can be some counterproductive or negative things. And the productive and the really positive stuff is shining a light on cancer, breaking down taboos, breaking down barriers, encouraging early presentation and action, but linked to good evidence, what the symptoms are, symptom awareness, how do you go and create action? That they're all really positive things. Public health messaging around the harms of tobacco and how you get help from tobacco to stop smoking, how you lead healthier lifestyles that reduce the risk of cancer, around weight management, around alcohol, all really positive messages. I think, as with every walk in life, there could be negative aspects where, you know, if there is a spotlight shone on something that does not carry an evidence base behind it, you know, of miracle cancer cures that are not related to medical evidence and medical fact, you know, with the worst thing being someone taking a message, well, I think I can treat this cancer myself, and not the established healthcare routes. Can I ask you about that whole journey of Rachel going through a cancer diagnosis, all your involvement with making cancer, shining the spotlight on it with a podcast, and knowing people so close to you going through it.
Yeah.
That decision-making of, if you're in the public eye, of do you share a cancer diagnosis when it's made? How do you kind of even begin to think about the you know, protecting yourself and looking after yourself, or a public responsibility? How does that work?
It was really interesting, actually. Back when Rachel was diagnosed, it was a slightly different time. This is 2016 we're talking about, in November 2016, and you know, things were a little bit different then. I don't think there was as much interest in people with cancer probably back then. You know, I think people like Deborah, people like Rachel have really accelerated that. And I don't think that we really knew kind of what the interest would be in her story. Rachel wasn't someone who was mega famous. She was sort of on the, you know, did a bit on Five Live, did a bit on the BBC News Channel, bits on the periphery. And I think her sharing her story initially was just a way of her not having to tell everyone all the time what was going on. She started blogging, and the blog, it became quite popular because at the time people weren't really sharing on Instagram, you know, the way they do now. And I was absolutely fine with it until her first kind of dodgy scan. And the first, you know, initially it seemed like things were going okay. You know, the first batch of chemo, there was some good response from the tumor, and it seemed like it was going okay. Everyone was quite jolly. The medical team were quite positive. Everything seemed all right. It seemed like it would be one of those breast cancers where you just do it and then you get through it and off you go into the rest of your life. And while I kind of felt like that, it was fine to share it. And I can remember really clearly after the first sort of dodgy scan, she was writing a blog post, and I said, like, do you really want to be sharing this? You know, the bad news as well, because it started to get quite a bit of interest by then. Quite a few newspapers were running, you know, various bits on us and on her. And she said, well, if I'm going to share it, I'm going to share it all. You know, I can't be like, you know, I can't be selecting bits to share, because that's not my story. That's not what's really happening. So, you know, I said, yeah, fair enough. But I'd never really encountered anybody having any interest in us or me in any way. You know, why would they? And all of a sudden, as Rachel went through her, just under 2 years it was until she died, but as she went through, the podcast, you know, grew and grew and grew, and it just went a little bit mental. I was saying to you before we started recording that the morning after she died, the Daily Express had a picture, the whole front page was just us, a picture of me and Rachel. And, you know, I don't think it all felt really surreal. It felt like, you know, opening a newspaper felt like I was reading about somebody else.
Yeah.
And felt very surreal, because particularly after she died, when the sort of level of interest, you know, really peaked, it felt like it was very difficult to actually, you know, just get a bit of headspace to do the grieving bit, which I obviously had to do. And it was a while before I felt like I could do that. You know, we were still getting a lot of interest even a couple of weeks after. And but I think the flip side to that is that I know we've helped a lot of people, you know, by Rachel sharing a story, by, you know, me hopefully continuing to share, you know, my story afterwards, and you know, the podcast with Deborah, obviously, with Lauren. You know, I know that we've helped people by doing that. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, however challenging it's been at times, you know, when you get a message saying that somebody listened to a podcast and, you know, even took a little bit of heart from it, it felt just a little bit like they weren't alone in what they were going through, you know, just makes it all kind of worthwhile. But it is, yeah, it was kind of mad at first. And not something that I was completely comfortable with.
And did she feel the kind of responsibility of sharing that, the journey and the messaging, and kind of that shining a spotlight on cancer and what that could do? Is that, I don't know, was it an extra responsibility or burden at that kind of time because of the
position? Yeah, I think it definitely was. It definitely was. It was something that she felt quite acutely, particularly as it started to go wrong, as it started to kind of look like it wasn't going to end well. She was very aware of, you know, the impact that could have, you know, how, you know, she became, you know, like I said, people weren't as open maybe as they are now. There wasn't the Instagram community, people sharing their stories like they do now.
Yeah.
And she definitely felt like she was letting people down when, you know, when she realized that she wasn't going to get better.
Wow.
And it was quite hard, but at the same time, you know, she did help so many people. And I really genuinely think the way that cancer is talked about now in so many places is in a massive part down to what those girls did when they started that podcast.
Yeah.
I believe
it's what we're talking about now.
It's absolutely massive. You know, Deborah, what she continues to do right up to the moment that she died, you know, and we'll come on to some, you know, some news around Deborah's fund a bit later, but you know, what she was doing, you know, just made people feel a little bit less alone. It made people feel like you were in some sort of cool club, you know, as awful as it was, you were in Deborah, Rachel and Lauren's gang.
Yeah.
And massively changed the way that I think, you know, we get messages all the time, and I know the girls have it too, you know, from people like you, people working in cancer, you know, who say, I have changed the way that I talk to patients because of, you know, things that you guys said.
Yeah.
So I think we, you know, I hope it, you know, as weird as it has been and as difficult as it has been at times, it's massively rewarding to know that you've actually done something to help some people.
Yeah.
It is interesting though. And it comes back to that, you know, Sarah Harding, I know was an interesting one. I know she was treated at the Christie and, you know, but I think she was quite private with it, wasn't she? And she chose not to talk about it. And I think, you know, it's everybody's decision, isn't it? Personal decision to decide whether or not they, you know, they want to tell the world what's happening all the time. But yeah, for us, it was, you know, I think we were quite naive at the start to not really knowing what the interest would be. And then by the time, you know, we kind of realized the cat was out of the bag a little bit and it kind of off it went. It got a life of its own. It was quite surreal, and it does continue to be quite surreal sometimes when some of the places that, you know, we've ended up in.
Yeah.
Thousands with cancer-causing condition offered life-saving NHS bowel cancer screening. NHS is offering a routine preventative bowel cancer screening to thousands of people with a genetic condition that increases their chance of developing certain cancers. And that's Lynch syndrome, isn't it, Matt? Do you want to just explain to everybody, and me mostly, what Lynch syndrome is?
So it's a genetic disorder So you inherit genes that make it more likely that you can develop cancer. They don't cause cancer themselves. It just makes the chance of developing certain cancers higher, and particularly bowel cancer and womb cancer or endometrial cancer. So it affects about 1 in 400 people. So in the UK, there's, you know, not far off 200,000 people with Lynch syndrome. And yeah, so this is a huge step forward. The risk of bowel cancer is so high, for anyone with Lynch syndrome, having the opportunity to access a high quality screening program to detect at the earliest possible stage when treatment is far more successful, is huge. And it's yet another step forward in the drive for early diagnosis of every single cancer that there is.
They're massively important, these screening programs, aren't they? And there's another one we can talk about. NHS has launched a national BRCA gene testing program to identify cancer risk early. And it's tens of thousands of people with Jewish ancestry.
We have a very strict and very robust process for anything to be approved as a national screening program, because there are potential harms from screening if it's not done, if it's not done properly, if you've not got a disease that you can detect that causes significant harm, that you've got a test that can detect it accurately, that it doesn't create false positives that lead on to unwarranted tests and potential harm, that you can incorporate primary prevention of a cancer within. There's all these criteria that are set to say, is this going to be an effective program that benefits people and doesn't create harm? And so however you look at that, so some programs may be very, very broad, a breast cancer screening program based on age, or a bowel cancer screening program based on age. Or you might find for certain cancers that there is a way of targeting to make sure that you are getting high-risk patients. So lung cancer screening has recently been approved nationally, but that's targeted to pick out those patients most at risk. And so it doesn't matter whether that's a small population or a large population, if you fulfill those criteria to say that this would be an effective screening program, then it gets approved nationally. So for Lynch syndrome, Manchester's really led the way in a lot of the research around Lynch syndrome, and have shown that for women diagnosed with endometrial cancer, it really works to screen them all for Lynch syndrome. And it will be cost effective to do so, and it will lead to benefit, because those patients then know that they have Lynch syndrome. It means that they could enter a bowel screening program that we've just talked about, because that's been approved. And the kind of the theme around that is knowing better. So is knowing that you're at greater risk of cancer. Doesn't mean you will develop it, but is knowing that you're at greater risk better. Because, I mean, I completely believe that knowledge is power. And that if you know that there's a risk, there's lifestyle changes that you could adopt to reduce your risk of cancer. We've talked about tobacco, weight management, alcohol. There may be screening programs, and that piece of knowledge, knowing, well, actually, I am at greater risk. So, and the engagement with screening programs, or if there are preventative strategies or things that can reduce risk, whether that's medication, whatever, you know, there are different risk reducing strategies in some cancers. Does it help that engagement and that knowing for you and for your family around you for inherited disorders? The BRCA gene testing, you know, there's a sixfold increase in that, in the prevalence of that gene abnormality. In those of Jewish ancestry, a sixfold increase. And that is associated with a higher risk of certain cancers, like breast, ovarian cancer, prostate cancer, pancreatic cancer. And so some of those have screening programs. Breast cancer has screening programs. Breast cancer has really advanced risk assessments, and there are, you know, there are strategies for reducing risks. There are hormone treatments that can reduce risk if you're deemed at a higher risk of breast cancer to try and prevent it ever from happening. So that knowledge becomes the power of how you manage that risk. But it's difficult, isn't it? Would you want to know?
I don't know. I don't know until I know. And then I think, like, if you did find out, then only then, you know, would you think, did I prefer, you know, life before? The breast screening is very interesting to me, because breast cancer is one that, you know, I think probably we all think we've got a decent grasp on it. I imagine if you ask a lot of people, they would think breast cancer is fairly treatable, because we hear so many stories of people being treated for it. And yet stats out at the end of January this year, a third of women, just over a third, still not taking up breast screening appointments. And actually 46.3% of women who are invited for the first time didn't attend their screening appointment. I found that extraordinary. Like, almost half of women invited for the first time. So you've never had a test before. You know, these are the people that you need to get tested. Almost half didn't go to their appointment. And I find that extraordinary. So you can have, you know, we've talked for years in our podcast about the amazing advances in technology and in treatment, surgical techniques and treatment, chemotherapies, immunotherapies, you know, all sorts of things coming around the corner. And yet, if you don't get someone into a hospital early enough in the first place, then you can have all the treatments in the world and you're not going to cure someone. So how frustrating is it that you're still seeing these numbers? 46.3% of people invited for the first time didn't attend their screen.
Yeah. I don't know if frustrated is the right word, or it's saddening, isn't it? It's because you're right. It's early diagnosis is the key to surviving cancer, full stop. And screening is the way. What screening is, detecting a cancer before it's got any symptoms. So it's the earliest possible opportunity to find it and treat it. The breast cancer screening program detects around 20,000 breast cancers a year. It's huge, absolutely huge. So I get there's a tragedy in there that what as a healthcare service, what have we done and what isn't right in our messaging to get those messages across? And why is it someone thinks, do you know what, that's not on my priority? And you can also, but you know, the challenges that people face in their lives, the financial difficulty, and what would it take to take for a day off work, or how easy is it to get to a hospital and have that done, and the impact that that could have. You could see how other priorities take over life. So what are we doing as a healthcare service to recognize those and help break down those barriers, and again, make action the easiest step rather than inaction? And that's our challenge. That's what we constantly got to be doing.
And help people understand that you're actually very lucky to be screened for certain cancers. You know, I did a piece for BBC Radio Scotland where I think I'm writing saying that the bowel cancer screening age is 50, and it's not 50 in England, is it? You know, so people who are 50 years old in Scotland get the chance to be screened for bowel cancer, and yet their numbers, for the number of people returning their tests, are really low. And you think, come on.
Yeah.
Like, how, I know we don't like talking about, you know, what's down there. I know we don't like checking our poo, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know.
And is that, the stigmas around it, and mammograms are very personal examination for women, for like you say, checking your poo and talking about it and doing the tests. We've got all these taboos to break down, and as I hope the progress is being made, and as you've said, for all the work that has gone on from and everything that Deborah did, and to try and break those taboos down, it will save lives. And we've got, I guess it's just that stark reminder. We may have come so far, but we've got so far to go, and we've got to keep doing it. And through whatever way is possible.
Yeah, not be too complacent when we do see these little spikes. Think we've got it cracked, because we haven't, have we?
No, absolutely not.
You mentioned Deborah. We're recording this on Thursday, the 7th of March. It's just been announced actually today. Some of about £5 million of the amazing 12.6 million that was raised so far in her honor for the Balbay Fund. They've given five million to a project team prospect at King's College London and Massachusetts General Hospital and Washington University in St. Louis, all about detecting bowel cancer earlier in under 50s, which I think is such important work, isn't it? I mean, you'll have heard this a million times. When it comes to bowel cancer, it's not just blokes in their 60s who eat too much red meat and drink too much red wine, is it? You know, Deb was a vegetarian, an active vegetarian female in her 30s when she got bowel cancer. It's breaking down those stigmas and perceptions and stereotypes of who gets certain types of cancer. And it's absolutely brilliant to see the money that was raised in her name while she was alive and after she died being put to such good work.
Yeah, that's incredible. And it cancer doesn't choose, cancer doesn't discriminate, it can affect anyone. We've faced a very similar story in lung cancer, in that it has such an association to tobacco, rightly, because 85% of cases are related to tobacco, but not all, absolutely not all. And we have this, there's been this risk of stereotyping of a working class male in their 60s and 70s that have smoked all their life developing lung cancer. But if you have a pair of lungs, you can get lung cancer. Yeah. And they're young, fit, athletic women from affluent communities that have been diagnosed with lung cancer. Not the image at all that would come across, you would think of, for lung cancer. Yeah. And we do. We have to challenge those stereotypes. We have to know that anybody can be affected with any form of cancer.
It's something I this is a terrible name drop, but after Rachel died, I got to know Andrew Strauss quite well, Sir Andy Strauss, and his wife Ruth died from she wasn't a smoker, but she died from lung cancer, and he's done lots and lots of work to raise awareness of non-smoking lung cancers and that kind of thing. Again, going back to the early part of our discussion, someone like him, the impact that he'll be having on I imagine lots of young men as well, who don't necessarily want to talk about these things, will be huge.
Yeah, absolutely. Breaking down those stigmas and making awareness that risks sometimes we could be guilty of because of those stereotypes, and that association with tobacco. A woman in her 30s coughing away could think, it will never be me. Never be me. But that kind of work, the Ruth Strauss Foundation and all the work they've done about breaking those things down, about link a symptom to cancer and make action the easy thing to do.
That's it. That's been all right, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Good fun.
Yeah. Enjoyed that.
Yeah. Interesting, isn't it? We'll try and do this sort of chat each month, because not a month goes by, Matt, does it? When cancer's not in the news somewhere, somebody will have got it.
Yeah.
Somebody sadly, may have died from it. There'll be something that's cured cancer. There'll be something that's caused cancer. Yeah. Burnt toast will have caused cancer. Yeah. all that kind of thing. But yeah, thank you so much for joining me, Matt. And thank you for listening to this episode of the GM Cancer Podcast. Like I say, we'll do one of these each month where we'll look back at the headlines that cancer is making. Until next month, thank you very much for listening.